Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with Mike Moran, pianist, composer, songwriter, husband of Kit Moran, who I interviewed last week. I'm also playing two cuts from his CD, Kit Moran Sings the Mike Moran Songbook, and I'm playing an interview with both Kit and Mike. I'm talking a little bit about what I do with the rest of the show on days that I am not playing complete interviews. But mostly, this is about the Kit and Mike Moran show. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about discovering who, and then becoming who, we really are. It is my belief, based on my 30-odd years of private practice as a psychotherapist, and also observing myself and everyone I know, that we are keeping secrets. Secrets about who we are, and we're not only keeping those secrets from everybody else, we're keeping the secrets from ourselves. So, for the first half of my show, I usually talk about how that happened, how we learned that some parts of ourselves had to be kept secret, and how we keep that secret going. And then, of course, how to undo that. The second part of my show I dedicate to interviews with people who make their living or their life with their art. Today, I'm going to skip talking about how we learn to keep secrets and go right to the interviews, because I'm doing two today. If you were listening last week, you heard the interview with singer, painter, all-around artistic woman, Kit Moran. Today, I'm interviewing her husband, pianist, composer, songwriter, supporter of Kit, Mike Moran. And also, I'm playing an interview I did with a couple. Whenever I find a couple, both of whom make their living or their life with their art, and and who have managed to stay together, I love to interview them because it's not that common. Also, I'm going to be playing a couple of songs from Mike Moran's CD. In fact, right after I stop talking, I'm going to play a cut from Kid Moran Sings the Mike Moran Songbook, although this particular cut's an instrumental. It's I Remember Errol. I understand that one of Mike's idols was Errol Gardner, and this is a tribute to him. So as soon as I stop talking, you will hear the tinkling of the ivories, Mike Moran doing I Remember Errol. Following that will be my interview with Mike. So here, pianist, songwriter, Mike Moran. So I'm here with Mike Moran in his lovely house. And Mike and I don't know each other.
No.
No, and he doesn't have any idea what I'm going to ask him.
I've never seen this woman in my life.
That's right. So I do this radio show, and I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
That's me.
I know. I know, I've seen you play, so I know. So I always ask people the same question. I always start out the same way. And that is, how did it happen to you? How did it capture you? How did you find it?
I think I was about 4 years old when I decided that I'd love to be able to create music.
At four?
Yeah.
Do you remember? I mean, you're saying that as though that's
walking,
a memory.
Walking through Central Park and, you know, hearing music on maybe somebody's radio or somebody was singing, and I thought, gee, that's wonderful.
So are you a New Yorker?
Yes.
Where did you grow up?
79th and Madison.
Oh, the real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I'm assuming, you know, you were with a parent or your family going mm-hmm. through Central Park, and this is really kind of interesting, this memory. Did you have music at home?
Well, we had a piano, a grand piano.
Did somebody else play?
Yeah, my older sister and brothers would play chopsticks and things like that, and I think my sister was taking piano lessons for a while, but I didn't hear much of that. But they would have fun doing chopsticks and things like
right.
that.
Right, so you also associated it with that was fun
was
somehow.
Fun, yeah.
Right. You're the baby boy?
I'm the baby.
Yeah. And so did you say to whoever you were with, wow, great, me, something, or you sort of took it in?
Yeah, it was pretty much internal only.
And then, so how did you act on it?
Well, eventually I started to teach myself piano.
You just sort of hung out at the piano?
Well, and yeah, I started learning how to play chopsticks, I learned how to play Here Comes the Bride with my elbow.
And are you serious?
I'm serious. On the black notes.
How old were you?
I think I must have been 7 or 8 by then, or maybe younger. I don't really remember. It's been a long time. But my mother detected what I was up to, and she thought, well, he should have piano lessons.
Finally,
too.
Somebody who actually is interested in the damn thing.
Right. Exactly right.
So did you have the same teacher as your siblings? Do you know?
No. I went to the Diller Quayle School, which was in the neighborhood, and they tried to teach me how to read music, and they thought they were teaching me how to read music, but I was just imitating what they did by watching and listening. So that didn't work out. Then it was private lessons at home, and I wasn't too happy with the classical teachers. And I finally got this teacher who, when he was a college student, he had played in the silent movies.
Oh.
And he was, at the time, I was taking these lessons in the 50s, I guess. He was what you'd call a club date musician. He would play with, you know, for dances and bar mitzvahs and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew how to play commercial music, and he taught me how to read fake books, which is what professional musicians read. It's just the melody,
chords.
The chord symbols.
Right.
Yeah.
So he taught you chords.
Yes.
And he taught you to play through changes?
Yes.
Or he just... Right.
He taught me to know the changes and how to
and play. How to get from one to
yeah.
the other. Right.
I mean, I started off as playing stride piano because that's what he did best, and I wish I could do it like that now. I kind of lost the touch, but that's what got me into it. And then I think on my 13th birthday, my oldest brother gave me a Billy Taylor album.
Oh my!
And
I
was
just
knocked out. And I brought the album to my teacher. And I said, "Hey,
how do you do this?"
Exactly.
Right. Well, you wanted to start at the top.
Well, I just yeah.
I'm Billy Taylor. My God.
Yeah.
You know, I was working in the South Bronx in the '60s, and Billy Taylor was doing this jazz mobile. That's right. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure.
You're the only other person I know.
That's a pretty famous institution.
I know, but not a lot of... Still, a lot of people don't know about that.
Yeah.
And that was him. I mean, he was...
Mm. Yeah, he was the driving force.
He was the driving force. That's right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's nice.
I developed a bit of a relationship with Billy. I was a fan of his, of course. And
from the time you were 13.
Yeah, and then when I was a college student, I had a radio program on WDCR, which was a commercial station at Dartmouth. And we would call artists and interview them. And we called Billy, and I didn't realize at the time that he was a radio person himself. So he gave us a great interview, and I on Thanksgiving vacation it was, I guess he was playing at the Hickory House in New York, and I went in and visited him at the gig, introduced myself, and he was most pleasant. And he said, "Have you ever met Duke Ellington?" I said, "No." He said, "Come with me." He took me to a table in the back of the room, by the kitchen door, I mean like the worst table in the Hickory House. And there was Duke Ellington, and he introduced me to Duke Ellington. I was just flying, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so and where are you in your development as a pianist at this point?
Still learning.
I don't mean today. I mean then.
Oh, then. Well, let's see, I had a group. I had a quartet.
Well, wait, did the piano teacher that you took the Billy? Did he say he could teach you that?
Or? He gave me what he could, but he didn't have.
He wasn't a jazz.
Billy's quartet. Well, he could play jazz, but it was an older style. He didn't have Billy's harmonic approach, which was what attracted me the most. I think. Shouldn't say that. Billy had everything going.
Yeah. Somebody told me. I think it was Mike Markovarich, that he heard Billy, I'm not going to get this right, it's something like Rhapsody in Blue, that he played it all with his left hand.
Really?
Something really out, he went with his wife, and they were listening, and she leaned over and said, "You know, he just played all of that with his left hand." I said, "Oh my God!"
Oh,
you know, it may not be Rhapsody in Blue, but it was something outrageous, you know. And I have to go listen to my interview with Mike to see what that was. But again, I mean, he's just, you know, I mean,
a giant.
He's a giant. That's right. Okay, so you got as far as you could with our stride playing guy.
And then I was taking lessons when I was in prep school, and actually in summers when I was at that age, I guess in my mid-teens, I had a trio of older guys. One was an advertising executive, one was a real estate operator.
And you?
One played bass, and I was the kid at the piano, and I had a bass and drums with me, and we would jam and draw a crowd at, you know, one person's house or another. Big thrill.
Yeah. It's real seductive.
And how.
Mm-hmm. Right. So did you think then that you were going to make a life of music?
No, I wasn't sure of that. When I went to Dartmouth, I was pre-med.
Aha. This must have gone down better with your family.
Well, yeah, it did, of course. But then I drank my way out of Dartmouth.
Which didn't go down that well with your family.
No. And I wound up at Boston University and got a degree in music composition there. And I was a much better student doing that.
Yeah, finally wound up where you belonged.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then where did you live and what did you do?
Well, I got out of school in Boston. I moved to New Jersey. I worked in the advertising business at medium-sized agency in Manhattan for about 5 years, and I rose to the position of media director. And then the agency lost two major accounts, and a son of one of the owners was in line for my job, and he got it, and I got out. At that point, I started writing children's books and actually got one published by Holt Reinhardt and Winston. But then it fizzled and I wound up unloading railroad trains and loading up flatbed trucks for a while. And
your parents saying, you should have been a doctor.
Yeah. And as I was about to turn 30, I thought to myself, I should be a musician. I mean, that's really what I'm built for and what I could succeed at.
I see. So 4 from 30 is what, 26? It took you 26 years to get back to where you were?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great though. So, what did you do?
I got a job, a friend of mine had opened a restaurant, a guy had sold me a life insurance policy, And he opened a restaurant and sent me an invitation to the grand opening, and I called him up and I said, how about giving me a job as a piano player? And I had, you know, played professionally really before. And he said, come on down, give us an audition. So I got the job. And within, I guess, a year and a half, I met Kit.
Well, so you two have been together a long time.
Since 1973.
Yeah, wow. So you've managed to make a life with music.
Yes, most of the time. I did do a little stint selling advertising space for a magazine in New Jersey. But the rest of the time it was playing piano.
That's pretty remarkable. I mean, you must know that that's...
Oh, I know. Yeah.
You know, we can count them on our fingers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you were right at 4.
Yeah.
Your instincts were correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming that your other siblings did not follow the musical path.
No. Although my surviving older brothers have both gone into showbiz in their own way. My oldest brother is doing a lot of films as an actor. These are not major films; they're student projects. Mm-hmm. And my older brother John is doing a lot of community theater, musical theater.
Oh God! Was there show business in the? I mean, your parents or?
No.
No, they were pretty straight ahead, your parents?
Well, I wouldn't call them that. But they were an unusual pair. He was a tough Irishman who built ships for the Navy. And she was a socialite. Her father was ambassador to Egypt during World War I. And she used to play bridge with Lawrence of Arabia and people like that.
They were an interesting combination.
Yeah, they were. And, of course, she swore she'd never marry an Irishman, and what did she do?
So she wasn't Irish, or she was?
No, she wasn't. She was a Protestant.
Yeah, right.
Mostly
right.
English.
Probably pissed off her family.
I don't know. I never heard about that.
No, they didn't talk about that.
Yeah, well, I was a lot younger than he. Yeah, I'd never met my grandmother, and my grandfather passed away, I guess, before I reached my teens.
So, but... There's no, I mean, it's really interesting that three of the four of you, how many kids were there?
There were four.
Yeah, three of the four of you found your way into the arts in one way or another.
Right. Well,
a family that...
Yeah, my older brothers are not really professionals.
Their lives.
They're retired and they're doing this because it seemed like a fun thing to do. I think they're envious of me, actually.
But that's probably right. Do you think that you were indulged in some way because you were the baby?
Well, I like to think of myself as my mother's favorite.
Well, you probably were, if that's how you think about yourself.
Yeah,
I mean,
people
don't make that up as a general rule. That's
well, some mothers tell every kid that they're the favorite.
Yeah, but the kids who are know it.
I guess so.
Yeah, no, that's... So that you didn't say, she said, I was her favorite. You said, I feel like I am. And that, I don't think you can manufacture that. That's, you know... And so the favorite quite often has permissions that the others don't.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And the youngest has advantages, too.
They can.
Yeah.
Yeah, they certainly can. There's also a price to pay for that, or there can be. I mean, some youngest kids who are indulged don't learn how to work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and also they can feel obligated to the parent that loved them so much. But it doesn't sound like you suffered from either one of those things.
No, I guess not.
No, the only thing that was problematic for you was, I don't know how to say this exactly, finding your way to yourself. I mean, you know, those years in between when you were sort of at odds with what was real for you, you know. But even then you did it fairly young. I mean, 30 is not that bad to have.
It seemed old at the time.
Oh, I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did.
I wasted all these years.
Yeah, but probably not. I mean, probably you couldn't have done it differently.
Probably not. Like there's a song, Marilyn and Ellen Bergman and Michel Legrand wrote called On My Way to You.
Uh-huh.
And it's, if everything hadn't happened the way it did, I never would have met you. That
right.
kind of a song.
Mm-hmm.
Tearjerker, really.
Right.
But a love song. I mean.
Yes.
Wonderful.
So I'm grateful for even all the things that mm-hmm. I hated at the time because
right.
if I would, because without, right?
Yeah, I wish the journey had been a little shorter, but, you know, at least 30's not too bad, as you say.
No, it really isn't.
Yeah.
Trust me. Well, all right, I like to ask people if there's anything I didn't ask you that you might want to talk about.
What I want to talk about? Well, I'm not just a pianist, I'm a composer, lyricist, and I...
Ah, yes.
And I've worked with Tio Macero, who was Miles Davis's manager and Duke Ellington's manager, and a musician and composer in his own right, and I worked with Don Sobeski on lyrics, and these are fairly big names in the mm-hmm. industry, and of course I write my own things. I've got an album out, Kit Moran Sings the Mike Moran Songbook.
Lovely.
18 of my tunes. And I think that's what I do best. I think I write better than I can play.
You know, it's very funny. I interviewed Duncan right before he went back, and he said exactly the same thing. He said he thinks he likes to think of himself as a songwriter,
mm-hmm.
and that he thinks he's a better songwriter than he is a player. This is so interesting. I've never heard that before, and now that's really interesting. So how did you find writing? I mean, how did you discover it or trip on it? Or?
Well, when I was thinking about it at age 4, it was, I want to create music, and not just sing other people's songs.
Oh, I have tears in my eyes.
I want to make melodies, and, you know, and I thought I could.
Well, apparently you were right.
I guess so.
So were you doing that in the interim and all along?
Yes. And when I finally went to study music formally at Boston University, it was composition, which is, you know, a very sort of useless degree to have. I mean, where do you go for a job with a degree in music composition?
Right.
But my composition professor, one of his first assignments was write down why you want to compose music. And my answer was, because I have to. And out of the whole class, he said mine was the only legitimate answer to the question.
Yeah. So you started writing music then?
In high school, I started writing.
Right.
And it's a compulsion, you know. Just most music is.
I have the same one, so I know.
Okay.
I do know. That's lovely. So, the other question I like to ask is, do you have anything that you want to say about what it's like to live a life that's dedicated to an art?
Well, I came from wealthy circumstances. And it, as I mentioned to my wife, it's hard coming down. She says, how do you stand it?
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's difficult coming down. We're the nouveau poor. And that's what it's like, but the reward is what you're doing. And, you know, you get so much out of that, you do as much of it as you can.
And anyway, you have to.
Yeah. There's a joke told about a tenor player who wins $250,000 in the lottery. And the local TV station or radio station is interviewing him. And he says, well, now, how is this going to change your life? And he says, well, I guess I'll keep playing till the money runs out.
Right.
And that's about it.
This is lovely, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
So there you have it, Mike Moran, pianist, composer, songwriter. Mike is a wonderful example of what I was talking about at the top of the show and what I talk about in all of the shows, that is the capacity to discover who and become who we really are. Mike is someone who knew who he really was from virtually the beginning of his life, and still he had to fight to become that. I hope that you gained some inspiration from Mike's story, because it is my belief, as I said at the head of the show, that we're all keeping a secret about ourselves, Mike was fortunate enough to be unable to keep that secret from himself. And so he was able, after, well, what did I say, 26 years, to become himself. Not all of us can do that. So as I said, I hope that you got some inspiration from that and maybe are asking yourself, you know, what is it about myself that I am not living out? And maybe why? And of course, I will talk more about that in the shows to come. But now I'm going to play another song from the Kit Moran Sings the Mike Moran Songbook, and this one we do actually have Kit. And this song is called What Would I Be Doing Without You? I'm playing it before the interview because I want you to hear in music what they talk about in words in the interview. You can hear in the interview what keeps Mike and Kit Moran together, and it's not only the music and their mutual love for it, but their acceptance, concern, compassion, care, and love for each other. So here, Kit Moran singing Mike Moran's song, What Would I Be Doing Without You? And then my interview with Kit and Mike.
Thank you.
am with Kitten Mike Moran. And mostly what I want to ask is, and I've done this before with other couples, so it's you're not the only ones, but I you know, it's special to for two people who make their a life with art to be married and to stay together. So I just wonder if you would talk about it a little bit. What I don't want to control it. So whatever comes to mind, you know, I keep wanting to give you a lead, and I don't want to because I don't want to direct it really. Just whatever you what might come to mind for you about what it's been like to share this life.
Well, my just feels as long as I'm happy, you know. We can live with this.
Well, there's the answer.
Well, you know, we started off working together and being together 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So we were very used to it, and we really enjoyed each other's company. It was always cracking me up, even at the supermarket. We do have a lot of fun together. I can't think of any place I'd rather be that would make me happier than to be with Mike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that we don't ever fight or anything.
We never
like
fight.
That. No. Yeah, we do.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
No.
Well, and you guys are funny too. So, do you want to talk about what it is, what it's like to work together? Whether living together and working together is it different? I mean, are you different on stage than you are at home, or
No, I don't think we are.
No, we're pretty much ourselves all the time.
Yeah. He likes to rehearse more than I do. I like to wing it more. But, you know, he's
that's kind of a personality difference,
I think,
right?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely much more grounded than I am.
Yeah.
Which is probably exactly what I need.
Well, I'm thinking that that's a balancing thing, you know. I mean, you might need the grounding. He might need the...
I don't know what the word
for that is, or, you know, the liberation. You see that a lot in couples, that kind of dichotomy. If the two people value the other thing, then it can work really well. But if they're busy trying to get the other person to be like me, then it can be problematic.
He'd like me to be more like him.
Yeah.
Well, that's not true. Every car needs a brake and an accelerator. You have to have both.
A very nice image.
And it doesn't. You don't want to go anywhere in that car if it doesn't have both of them.
No, that's probably right.
So it works out very well, I think. And in my case, I've always enjoyed accompanying a soloist. It's been, surprisingly to me, one of the things I enjoyed doing as soon as I started doing it.
Well, but it's interesting because that's a very special skill, accompanying. And in my experience, a lot of musicians don't have it. And they're not, you know the old joke, some musician dies and goes up to heaven and they say, oh, you're going to love it here, you know, Miles is here and Duke is here, and there's only one problem, and that is that God's girlfriend's a chick singer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
it's all
everybody's
over.
Right, exactly.
It's ubiquitous.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, really?
That'll do it. That's right. I wasn't
that
either,
one.
But that's that'll do. Yes, exactly. But it's true. A lot, you know, a lot of musicians think that the soloist is problematic.
Right.
You know, and not a lot of pianists, you know, really want to share the
spotlight.
The spotlight, right? And so. A lot of musicians don't want to share this.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, they don't like singers at all.
But they like you. This is true. I mean, I think there are musicians who are drawn to Kit. They want to play behind her because she's doing such a great job. I mean.
So it's a kind of an unusual thing. So do you have any idea? I mean, were you doing that before you met
Yes.
Kit? And so you knew even before you met Kit that you liked doing that?
That trio I had as a teenager, every now and then there would be this wife of a guy who worked for IBM who should have been a singer, but she never got the chance and never took the shot. She would sit in with us, and that was just a gas for me because I found myself feeling needed for one thing.
Yes.
And making something bigger happen than just the trio.
That is so lovely. I don't think I've ever heard a musician say that. Hmm. You know,
the two things, you know, the being needed and the making something bigger happen. I think both of those are true, but a lot of times you just don't see much of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know where you got that?
I don't.
Well, so this is a perfect this is perfect for a singer. I mean, like, who could?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, right. I imagine that really is important to the relationship, because it's not in any way a competition.
Right.
Well, we complement each other too. I mean, I call Kit my mouthpiece because she does all the talking, and when I write a song, she's the one that puts it over, makes a great recording of it. I mean, I couldn't ask for better.
No, and she's got the support, yeah, you know, of somebody who, well, provides this material for one thing, but to know that you can lean on, count on.
Exactly. You know, I mean, in one way, if I ever, when I sing with another musician, no matter how great they are, I get a little nervous, mm-hmm, you know, but I know what's going to happen with Mike.
Yeah.
So it's very comforting.
Yeah. And you can take all kinds of risks with a thing like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I don't know, it's just, it just gets more fun all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I imagine that professional complementariness, you know, has to find its way into your personal life. Complementing each other, making room for each other, allowing the other to be benefiting from what the other has to offer.
The other couple I can think of that was kind of like us was Jackie and Roy.
Oh, I was just thinking about them. Yeah.
Jackie and Roy were chick singer and pianist.
Jackie Kane,
except
Kane
he sang
and Roy
also.
Crow.
Yeah, Jackie Kane and Roy Crowe.
Yeah.
And they were very tight. And we'd run into them. We lived in the same town in New Jersey for a while, in Montclair. We'd run into them on the street.
And we were always dressed up. We were always in like a tux and a gown or something in the middle of the day getting picture taken or something. And it was, you know, it's Montclair's small town. And and they were always like, where are you guys going? Or just go for lunch. But they worked together and married for many, many years. You know, I mean, so we've known people like this, I guess. So it's, I guess when you talk about, you know, how do people stay together, there is a real, I think you have to want it. And when you say work at something, it sounds like, oh, we've got to work at this. But you do have to work at it, and you do have to allow the other person their time. I didn't even know about that. I was so young that, you know, he'd like be off on his own, like writing a song or something. I'm going, hey, what about me? What about me? You know, hey, you're not paying attention. Don't you love me anymore? You know, and I had to really learn that. And now, I mean, I love it. So we have as much as we are together, you know, 24 hours mm-hmm. a day, we really respect each other's alone time.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I hear, and again, I'm making this up, is that you found a way to let each other evolve to become who you are.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, absolutely. No matter what I do, he is so behind whatever I want to do. Mm-hmm. So behind it. And will help me be behind whatever, I mean, just like, hold my back. Mm-hmm. Like I wanted to take painting. Oh yeah, sure, go ahead. And now it's like, you know, I want to go paint. Go ahead, go do it. What do you need? He'll take the pictures. He'll do this. He'll, you know, I mean, it's, who could want for anything more?
Well,
really,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of how many people have this kind of support behind them. I hope I'm half that supportive of him as he is to me.
You know, what I hear in that is that it isn't only as the accompanist that you like the feeling of being needed.
Oh, yeah. I just get a kick out of seeing what Kit finds herself able to do, write a show, paint paintings, award-winning paintings. I think it's great to see her. Because I think I sense sort of an inferiority complex in Kit when we first got together. And I've been trying to talk her out of that ever since.
But again, it's that, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if I were going to put the label on you, it would be, you know, supporter, encourager.
Enabler.
Enabler. Well, that has come to be a dirty word. But in the way that you talk about it, it's very lovely. And actually, the only problem with enabling is if you're enabling something that's destructive to the person, which clearly you are not, and if you have resentment, which clearly you don't. So then it seems to me really a kind of perfect, you know, if, you know, she was pretty young, so that whatever you were perceiving as a inferiority complex may simply have been that she was young and didn't really know herself yet.
And I think another thing is that, you know, I've always said to him, oh, I could stop singing anytime, you know, and I would not miss it. I would, but I think because he really had to fight to become a musician, because he came from a family that expected him to be a doctor or a lawyer or a stockbroker.
Right.
And then he got married and to somebody else, and they wanted somebody to, I want you to support me, and you don't have talent. You can't make it like this. You got to do blah blah blah. So he was always struggling and fighting to say no. This is me. This is what I am. This is who I am, and I want to do it. When we met, that's what I allowed him to be. I just thought, well, he's a musician. I don't care about what his family said or his first wife said. To me, he is a musician, and that's what it is, you know. And I grew up just having everybody say, you're great. You can do anything you want, you know. I mean, as a kid, I mean, I never thought I'd even get married or have a kid because I was going to work. Never occurred to me that I wasn't going to work. And so we really come from two different backgrounds. So when I say I could quit, because I didn't struggle for it. Right. I didn't have to fight to say, I'm going to sing, you know. So I sing. So that's what I do.
Well, that inferiority thing, I think, happened when you talked me into joining Mensa. And then you were afraid to take the Mensa test.
No, I wasn't afraid to take it.
Well, you never took it.
I didn't think I had to take it.
Oh, good.
and not because I think I'm Mensa, because I don't think I am.
I think you might be.
Okay, I'll give you that.
But it does sound like you guys saw something in the other that you could support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and you saw in the other something that you valued, and so the other could feel valued.
When I saw somebody with so much integrity and fidelity and to be a wonderful musician on top of it, I mean, seriously, would there be something wrong with me? You know, and you know, I'd come out of a couple of stupid relationships, you know, being young and all, and I just remember saying, that's it, I'm done with bad relationships, I'm done with being unhappy, I learned what I had to learn, I can sing sad songs anytime now I want to learn how to sing happy songs. And so when I met Mike, I thought, that was fast.
Yeah.
And just saw him as this, a rock, somebody that was, you know, like, I could just really, really, really depend on.
Yeah.
He would not let me down.
No, and apparently he hasn't.
And that was since 1973. He has not let me down.
Well, you were right, yet again.
Again. I knew what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that other thing, I mean, I keep coming back to it because I think it's so lovely.
that, I'm not articulating it all that well, that the thing you saw in each other was what the other one wanted to be seen as. Do you know what I mean?
Well, we mirror each other, mirror what we want.
Yeah. And so to be seen as who you want to be seen as.
Ah, very good.
I mean, it's so powerful, you know.
That's really, really good. All right, now how much we pay you for this session?
I'm just paraphrasing, you know. I mean, I'm just feeding back. That's you know. And it's, I really think that there's almost nothing so potent as that, you know.
Wow.
And so congratulations to you. My God, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful to see. It's really, it really is, you know.
Oh, thanks, Lynn.
Well, okay, so is there anything you want to say about coupling, about working together, about sharing a life of art? Or
it's the best life I can think of.
Damn right.
Yeah, and you had a few other lives before that. You know what you're talking about.
Yeah, right, right. But you finally did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Made the right turn.
That's right. Well, congratulations to both of you. I'm really happy to have done this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Kit and Mike Moran, a couple who demonstrate that it is possible to make your living and or your life with your art and at the same time live with someone who is making his or her living with his or her art, and in this case, with many arts. I have treated many, many people who are either are or trying to make their living or their life with their art. And I can tell you that for a lot of people, doing that is hard enough. And living with somebody else who is trying to do the same thing can be a burden and a complication and a difficulty. But as you can hear with Kit and Mike, it is not only not a burden, it is a terrific support. And so there's lots to be learned from Kit and Mike Moran and the way in which they do their art and their lives. This week, as you heard, I spent the entire show with the two interviews, Mike's and then the one with Kit and Mike. Next week, I'm going to revert to the real format of the show, the real theme of the show, discovering who you are and then becoming it, figuring out why you may not be able to do whatever it is that you want to do, think you need to do, maybe believe you have to do. I will be talking about that in the first half of the show, as I do in most shows. And the last time I was talking about cover story, next week I'm going to talk about undercover. That is where you put all of those qualities which you decided as a child somehow didn't work. They didn't fit with the cover story that you were designing. So you may not even know that you have an undercover. You may not know that you have qualities that you hidden even from yourself. But I will be talking about that at the beginning of the next show, and then I will be doing an interview with yet another person who is making his life and more his living with his art, which is comedy and filmmaking. And so I hope that you'll be here for that. Before I end the show, I will, as I always do, express my undying gratitude to Josh Hackney, who shows up every week and makes sure that the sound of this show is as good as it can be and helps me to do those things which I either cannot do or used to know how to do but have forgotten. I don't know. You know, if you weren't raised with this technology, well, maybe you can do it. I forget. But it doesn't matter because Josh is always there at my back, the wind beneath my sails. And so if you need somebody at your back, or you need wind beneath your sails, or you just need somebody to run it by, then you want Josh. And, of course, as always, you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, thelynshow.com. Click on email me and say I want Josh. Or ask me a question. Or go and listen to the podcasts of the old shows if you're curious about the kinds of things I've been talking about, if you're only a somewhat new listener to the show and you're curious about the things I've talked about in the past, you can get it all there. So now, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, or something that amused you or interested you, or, well, anyway, something that'll bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with the wind.